ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Henrik. This is Red Ice TV. Great to have you with us. We do have a video version available of this show, if you so please. Definitely check it out at redice.tv or our YouTube channel, of course, where you can see the video version. And we have no other than Gilad Atzmon back on the show. He has a new book out called Being in Time. I've gone through the book. Excellent as usual. It's great to have you back on the show, Gilad. Thanks for coming on.
It's great. Pleasure to be with you, Father.
Excellent. So before we talk more about the book, tell us about your, you were doing a tour recently. You just told me before we came on here, you were attacked by some Antifas in Scotland. Tell us about it.
Yeah, for the first time in my life yesterday, I was attacked by these three relatively small guys. I mean, relatively, because I'm quite big. I survived it. I'm here. But it is really the first time in my life that I encounter physical violence, and it is clear to me that they try to terrorize me into silence, and I'm happy to announce that this is not going to happen. The more violent they are, the more peaceful and harmonious will be my reaction. I think that, and we are going to talk about it later, I'm pretty sure, this idea of the left becoming an institutional book burner, or left, or radical, or progressive, or what you want to call it, is far from being a surprise. In fact, my book, Being in Time, explains exactly how it happened, and why it happened, and what are the leading elements that led us into this dystopia in which we live, tyranny of correctness. And I argue as forcefully as I can, and I believe that my argument is forceful enough for people to follow it, that if we want to save ourselves, we must reinstate Athens in our midst as soon as possible. We have to work out on it, and I'm actually determined to do whatever I can to make sure that people understand how grave the situation.
Explain that difference to us there. You talked about the Athenian way and then the Jerusalemites, I think you call the opposite. Yeah. Tell us about these two.
Yeah, it is very crucial. Athens is the birthplace of philosophy. Athens is the place where we think things through. Athens is where science was born. Athens is where beauty was born. Music. Athens is everything we associate the West with. Athens is intellectual exchange, a culture of debate. Jerusalem, on the other end, is the place of revelation, the city of revelation, the city of yes and no, 10 commandments. Do that, don't do that, don't do that. Jerusalem is the city of chosenness. We know what is right. We know how to get things better. I believe that the problem that we encounter now in the West is has something to do with the fact that we were under the helm of Jerusalem for too long. Now, when I talk about Jerusalem versus Athens, I'm not talking about Jews versus Goyim. Unfortunately, Hillary Clinton is a Jerusalemite. When she doesn't agree with some people, they become a basket of deplorables. She doesn't debate them. Tony Blair is a Jerusalemite. Theresa May is a Jerusalemite. These people are not Jews. The Jerusalem ideology is, in fact, entrenched in progressive thinking. What do I mean by that? Progressive thinking, thinkers, or I don't know progressive thinkers, progressive people, sorry about it, progressive people always know what is right and who is wrong. They're not happy to challenge any idea or to open ideas to debate. They always know what is right and what is wrong. Palestine is colonialism, apartheid, obviously, you know, I take Palestine because it's this was the time very familiar with. The white Americans, they don't agree with become rednecks. The fact, and people don't think about the fact that people who used to be leftists are now looking down on people who have a redneck. Redneck is there because people are exposed to the sun because they walk in the field.
Right.
Suggest a clear detachment between the left that used to be there for the lower classes, for the farmers, for the workers, and the people themselves, the blue collars. And this is why, for instance, Trump was won. And we see something very similar in Britain, you know. Corbyn is doing quite well. And in fact, I hope that he will do well enough to win these elections, despite the fact that I have huge problems with him. Huge problems with him, and we can talk about it because it is relevant. My problem with Corbyn is that he is also a Jerusalemite, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to the left, I want to believe that Marx was primarily Athenian, but the problem is that all the Marxists are Jerusalemites. They turn Marx into a dogma that is basically a religious dogma that mirrors the strictness of the Talmud, if you understand what I'm saying.
Right.
The thing that is very painful to admit is that when it comes to Corbyn, he never had a day job in his life, a proper day job. I mean, playing saxophone or going to a factory.
Right.
The same applies to Mr. Bernie Sanders. Can you see Bernie Sanders doing 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. in a factory? Did he ever do it? I don't think so. And this is why American blue-collar workers ended up voting to a billionaire that resembles their thinking, or let's say they believed that it resembled their thinking. They were probably wrong. And you know, if you want, we can talk. We can analyze the American election or American contemporary politics from this perspective of Athens versus Jerusalem. But it's very, very interesting.
Yeah, so let's talk a bit about this aspect then, that they're the chosen ones, right? They have the right position. You can never question them. It's, I guess what happened to you is kind of a microcosm version of the bigger picture. I think you're aware of what's happened in Berkeley, what's happened at all these historically free speech sites, basically, right? Where the left, the Antifa has now come in and basically is violently opposing anyone who, in their mind, it comes from this wrong position, right? So what you're describing, what you're talking about, is that the cultural values that the West have now adopted is one that is not of free thinking, free speech, inquiry, the scientific mind, let's discuss this philosophically. Yes. That's out of the picture. That's gone right now.
The one thing that was probably most crucial in the left is, or was, sorry, because it doesn't exist anymore, was dialogue. How is it possible that we are silencing dialogue on the most important issues? Now, when it comes to, you know, I was blamed this week twice for communicating with Holocaust deniers. In my universe, there is no such a thing as Holocaust deniers. In my universe, I'm not familiar with anyone who tried to argue that Hitler liked Jews, for instance, or that Hitler didn't want the Jews to be expelled from Germany. Hitler clearly didn't like Jews. He wanted them out of Germany. What? And there was no one doubts for a second the Jews in Europe suffered enormously under occupation. By the way, they also suffered when they tried to liberate themselves. Britain and America didn't open their gates to the Jews, and this is something that we don't like to talk about. There are some historians who argue that if Swiss Jews prevented Ostjuden, European Jews from the East, from coming into Switzerland and so on and so on, we don't talk about it. What people really debate is the particularity of this discrimination. What really right. happened there? You know, now, I argue in The Wandering Who and in my current work, and I at the moment I have to write it pretty much once a day, if history is the attempt to narrate the past as we move along, and this is very important, then what it means in practice is to write proper history is to re-examine, reopen, or in short, revising the past. And this is, for me, the essence of humanity. History is revisionism. This is the only thing that makes history into a meaningful adventure. Revisionism.
Looking at it. Examine it. Right.
Examine it as we move along, as we change. And I give you a beautiful example that people are not familiar with, but it explains very well. As many people start to accept now, in 1948, we see just 3 years after the liberation of Auschwitz, the newly erected Jewish state is engaged in a crucial maneuver that leads to an ethnic cleansing of 75% of the Palestinian indigenous people. This is a devastating event for the Palestinians. It is called the Nakba. But interestingly enough, no one in the West or in Israel looks into this event. It is not the Palestinians, as much as they tormented by their plight, they're living in refugee camps, and yet nobody looks into it. However, in the 80s, following the crisis in Kosovo and the rise of this new notion of ethnic cleansing, some Palestinian historians and Israeli new historians start to understand that what happened in 48 was also an ethnic cleansing. So it was actually the historical involvement that led to the creation of a new notion of ethnic cleansing that helped us to understand an event that happened 40 years earlier in Palestine. So suddenly the Nakba came into life in the 90s. This is exactly what real history is. Now, I'm, for instance, another similar issue. I'm reading now David Irving. And I'm reading David Irving, The Destruction of Dresden. And it is very important for me, it was very important for me to put my hands on this book. You know, it's not very easy to get his book because shops in this country really prefer not to sell it. And when I read David Irving, it is very clear to me that his approach to history is essentialist. What he tried to do is to define patterns of thinking that are more than just historical events that are put into a chain, a chronological chain. Right. If, for instance, when he speaks about the destruction of Dresden, he speaks about a premeditated genocidal attempt against the German working people, working class, against civilians. Now, this is, for me, whether he is right, whether he is wrong, this is a fascinating way to look at history. This is when history becomes a categorical pattern. And why it is so important to read David Irving now, despite the fact that we are not allowed to read it, because we are doing exactly the same thing in Iraq. We are doing exactly the same thing in Syria. We are doing exactly the same thing in Libya.
Yeah, that's right.
If we would be able to open our society to the Athenian ethos, which means that if you have a problem with David Irving, you must invite him to an open debate.
Right.
You must encourage everyone to go to listen to him and to argue with him. If he would manage to reinstate this idea, we are going to save ourselves. Otherwise, we are doomed. And this is the real meaning of being in time. This is what I try to do, because instead of doing it, what we do, we are engaged in a desperate attempt to silence everyone who has something meaningful to say.
That's right. Yep.
And as a result, our political system has nothing to do with us anymore. And this is the full title of Being in Time. It's Being in Time, a post-political manifesto.
Yeah.
What I describe in the book is that unique process that detached us as people from the political system. When we were young, when I was young, you probably weren't there, in my age, I'm 53, 54, I think this year, we still remember that in the 70s and the 80s, when we were pretty young, there was kind of this liberal democracy fantasy. We could see a lot of problems, but we tended to believe that the system was right and it can retune itself, because we saw kind of a continuum between us, the people, and the politicians. The politicians were kind of representing our wishes, our whims, and so on and so on. At a certain stage, we were reduced into consumers, and the political system was there to sustain consumption by means of credit. They were basically working for big money as opposed to us.
Right.
Now, the way I analyze, tackle this very interesting transformation in the book is as follows. I said, how is it possible that such a huge metaphysical shift takes place in our society without the academics pointing at it and explaining it, or at least trying to explain it? How is it possible that the media keeps us blind to the fact that the political is drifting away? And I came to a conclusion, and this is the first big chunk of elaborate thinking in the book. I came to a conclusion that the two elements that facilitate this shift and our blindness to the change are A, tyranny of correctness, political correctness; B, identity politics. And it's very easy to explain. The first thing that they really do, the fact that they did actually, was dividing us into identity groups. So while in the old days, the left used to say, and I remember it, it doesn't matter if you're man, woman, gay, black, we are all together against the bad guys, the capital, Wall Street, the city, and so on and so on. Instead of saying that, they taught us to speak as a, as a woman, as a Jew, as a lesbian, as a gay, as a black, as a. Rather than fighting for the most important things in society, which are production, education, and health, we started to fight each other. Identity, sectarian wars. All that time, manufacturing was out of the window. Health services, national health, evaporated.
Mm-hmm.
Academia became an industry. My kids are studying in university. I visit universities often enough. You look at these kids, they pay tens and sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars of pounds getting degrees that was nothing. So they continue to master in gender studies,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yep.
or women's studies. You want to be a woman? Come to me 1 week. I'll explain you everything. You know, it is pathetic, and it became an industry, and it became an industry because there is no other industry. Because if you finish your studies in engineering, there is no factory
exactly.
for you to work.
Yep.
And I tell you something that's completely idiotic. You know, I never had. I live in this country for 25 years. As a youngster, and my father always had British cars. I never had a British car. I thought that they're kind of, they look funny, and people were laughing at me. And, you know, obviously I'm not a car guy, but my car is broken now for 2 weeks, and I've the garage gave me a courtesy car, and I'm driving Rover 75. I don't know if you remember, but it looks a bit like Jaguar.
Is that Rover? You said.
Yeah, Rover.
Yeah.
It's not a Land Rover, it's kind of
I think I know which one you mean, yeah.
Never mind, but it's a kind of a semi-luxury family car.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of, it looks like a Jag. Man, I was driving today from, and it's old, it's like 12 years old or something, and I was driving today from Scotland to London. I just arrived an hour ago. It is the best car I've ever been in. And you know, when I think about the idea that the British people allowed all this, hey,
I found one. There's the Rover 75. Yeah.
Really quick. You know, the idea that the British people allowed these factories to evaporate, it is shocking.
I know.
It's shocking.
It's a crime.
It's a crime. And here we are starting to tackle a very interesting insight, I think, and this is something that we understood when Trump was elected, and I think that this is also the charm of Corbyn and even Bernie Sanders and even Obama, believe it or not, that Trump was voted in. Suggests that for working class people, utopia, that is such a fundamental notion within left thinking, is in fact nostalgia. Trump won because he promised to make America great again. It is the again that we are fascinated with. Corbyn is so exciting for many Brits because he is an old lefty. It is the nostalgia to the old left that looked after national health and the workers and so on and so on. Obama was popular for the same reason. It looked as if we have now a twist out of the a counter movement to the post-political condition. We suddenly felt that here there is a politician who is really an extension of our wishes, our whims, and so on and so on. And as we happen to learn time after time, once these people are in power, they are committed to Goldman Sachs.
Right.
They trade with Soros, and we are left in the same place. And the way I explain it in a metaphorical way in the book, I speak about those beautiful skyscrapers that we see in every big capital in the world. We see it in New York, we see it in LA, we see it in London, we see it in Frankfurt, Paris, all those beautiful glass towers that usually occupied by big banks, traders, Wall Streeters, and so on and so on. And I argue that these buildings are made of glass in order to convey a sense of transparency. But when you get close to these buildings, you realize that you cannot look inside because the windows, these glass windows, are not transparent. They're actually mirrors.
Reflective,
when you
yeah.
Try to look, yeah. Why would you, when you try to look inside, all you see is yourself standing out in the street in the cold. This is the real meaning of the post-political condition. We are left out in the street in the cold. Our political system, our mammonites drifted away. This is something that happened because of the betrayal of the left. And it's actually not the old left, because the left itself was invaded. It's now an occupied zone. It's a Jerusalemite occupied zone. It was invaded by identity politics, by this idea of breaking society into identity groups.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't fight together. Now, how is it possible? How is it possible that we got to that point without being able to fight back? Political correctness. What is political correctness? Political correctness is politics that doesn't allow political opposition. So we made sure that you are not allowed to criticize any form of identity politics, and we made sure that you are not allowed to point at those Mammonites who destroy our walls and make our universe into a devastating dystopia. And this is pretty much the program that facilitated this current post-political condition.
So obviously they have done this not because they are, you know, necessarily interested in debating or interested in, you know, holding back the other side. I think they've done it just because of the fact that they wanted to win. They wanted to find a strategy that worked. They wanted to find a way of, I guess, some of these postmodern thoughts, what are they talking about? That the end of history, right? That everything has come to an end. It's a close. We've everything is contained, for the lack of a better term, right? Everything is, they got everything under control. There's no surprises left. Everything is studied. Everything is known. It's all there. Now it's just a matter of just kind of completing it. That's the globalist's goal, right? Of basically saying, we have it under control right now.
This is exactly the issue. I try to identify who is it or what is it that facilitated this shift. And again, I could find two elements that led it, at least intellectually.
Mm-hmm.
One devastating finding, and I'm not very original here, but it was still very devastating for me to admit that there is an element of more than element of truth in it, is that there is an animosity that is embedded in left thinking towards the working people. And why? Because the working people always vote for the wrong people. They vote for the Tories. They vote for Donald Trump. They never vote for Corbyn. Even now, by the way, Corbyn is doing well. Still, within British working people, he is only 50% share of the votes around. It's not that the working class people are running to the labor. No. And it is very easy to explain. The working class people never made the revolution into reality.
Right.
Why?
Right.
You come to a working working class person and you tell him, listen, we meet tomorrow at 12 o'clock, Piccadilly Circus, and we start a revolution. And they will tell you, are you crazy? 12 o'clock, I'm at work. Working class people are the people who go to work. They don't have time to do revolution.
That's right.
And the left is very angry. And this is why the left has become a movement of Guardian readers who have enough time to contemplate with some strange ideas. And the working people are actually more excited by the flag, by Donald Trump, by the nationalist ethos. And it is very simple. If you adhere to the flag, let's say the British flag, Newton become part of your remote family. Shakespeare is your brother. D-Day, you won World War II. You are the biggest empire. This is something that there's a lot to be proud of. The Jews know about it very well. You know, they reinvented themselves as nation, as a nation, and King David and the Bible became their ancestry roots.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There is something fascinating about nationalism that the left is yet to tackle. What did they do instead? They said, okay, it doesn't work out for us with the working people. What we will do instead, we will divide them.
Well, that's what they're doing. Let's flood them with migrants. Let's create multiculturalism. And then,
so
you know.
Immigration, multiculturalism, the destruction of the church, the destruction of the patriarchal family.
Traditions.
Big list of things, and basically the destruction of all forms of hegemony. There is a big debate whether it was a conspiratorial attempt or whether it was really an attempt to improve the situation, because there was discrimination, there were a lot of there was racism, there was discrimination, prejudice, and so on and so on. So I didn't manage to come with an answer, but you know, I don't have to come with every answer to every possible question. I know that there are some different answers, and I cannot conclude how did it happen.
Right.
So this is the left. This is the left. Why the left bought into this idea, ideology.
However, I've said it every time you've been on, Gilad, but however, I got to bring it up again so people don't get mad at me for it. But the only identity, of course, that's not allowed is white identity, right? So
exactly. Now we are going to talk. I think that we are almost ready to deal with the white identity. Because, by the way, I'm an anti-identitarian.
Right, yes? I know that, yeah.
So, I'm anti-identitarian. And in my tour in America, I met quite a few white identity enthusiasts. And I told them, listen, you know, if you are going there, you are actually, you know, you also become adopted this Jewish philosophy. And I'm not sure that this is the right way to go, because we covered the left, but the left wasn't alone leading in this identitarian shift. Jewish intelligentsia also was prominent in pushing for this shift. In fact, when it comes to the intellectual input, it is very clear that the Jewish scholars, ideologists, and so on and so on, were actually at the vanguard of this shift. Why Jews? Jews had bad experience with working class around the world. We know about Germany, and it extended to Europe. They didn't feel welcome enough within American kind of evolving society. They always felt rejected. And the way to handle this situation was to break the working people into identitarian groups.
Because I think, just a quick comment on that, because I think what's happened is that if we look at, you know, BLM, Black Lives Matter, or let's say the Muslim identity around the world in their diaspora as they are, you know, invading into the West on orders of all these globalists and multiculturalists, they have been allowed to maintain and keep their identity based on a racial level. But for white people, it's turned into, you know, transgenderism or gay issues, or I'm into, you know, Lord of the Rings. It's these subcategories of identity for white people, which ultimately divides us as well to a point where we can't collectively kind of compete with these other groups, right?
I totally agree. I totally agree with you. And there is something, and you may notice it as well. When I was young and I would meet an American, and I'll ask him, where are you from, or, you know, what are you? And I would hear something like, I'm an American from Florida, I'm a New Yorker, and so on and so on. When you ask the same question nowadays, what you hear is something like, oh, I'm an Italian, French, Swede. I am Russian, Polish, Irish. You hear kind of all those ancestry roots. The American, even the American subject is now broken into these sub-identities, which is there to break any form of unity or national identity or collective identity that that could lead you out of this mad disaster. And we see reaction to this attitude all over the world. What is Brexit? Brexit is where half of the Brits are saying, we had enough of this as a bullshit, as a woman, as a Jew, as a we want to be Brits. And 50% of the Scots want to be Scots. They said it means nothing to us to speak as Scots in Britain. We want to be Scots, proper. Now, this is very interesting because we are moving from identity into being. We are returning to Heidegger. What do I mean by that? Instead of talking as a gay, let's say that I'm an homosexual. I'm obviously not, so it's an easy exercise. If I'm an homosexual, I love to sleep with other boys. This is my sexual preference. Fine. If I'm gay, I identify politically as an homosexual. Actually, I'm removed from my authenticity and I start to think, what would gay do in a given situation? This is the difference between being a Jew and being a Zionist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jews know what they are. When they identify as Zionist, they start to ask, what am I supposed to do accepting a given identity? I'm a saxophonist. I never identified as a saxophonist. I don't have to. I have a huge record of recordings, performances, and so on and so on. I don't have to identify. Identification basically removes us from our authenticity. And this is my criticism of all forms of identities. However, I would agree with you. If Jews can identify as Jews, and black can identify as black, and lesbian can identify with their biology, and transgender can identify with their biology, surely white people can identify with their biology,
yeah,
with their culture. If I again, I'm an anti-identitarian, but if it's kosher for Jews to do it, for black, for lesbian, it is kosher for everyone.
Of course.
In that sense, I'm a universalist, and I accept this program.
Yeah, because I think it's ultimately, you know, what I see in a way, the movement, this progressive movement that has pushed us so far off the edge of civilization. Now we're really at the brink of it, at the edge, as it were. And it's a kind of a make it or break it scenario. I feel right now it's getting too crazy out there. It's just too insane when it comes to the levels of progressivism that we have. But I've always seen that the move towards this insanity has been done as a way to deconstruct society, to deconstruct our culture, to deconstruct, I wouldn't say necessarily then our identity, because I understand what you're saying with that, but the things that we identify with, be that our biology, our racial family, or if it's our culture, or tradition, or heritage, or language group, or whatever it might be, it's been just one big movement of destructiveness in those ways, because I think, and you argue this in the book too, this has been one of the best ways, I think, for big finance, for the globalists to control people. It's basically to give them a new sense of identity, which is not rooted in authentic cultural, you know, and heritage, if you see what I'm saying. It's a faux identity. It's something which is just very new and recent. It's not old. It's not ancient. It's a way for them to control us, basically.
To make sure
we become, you know, slaves that they're on their global plantation, right?
I totally agree. And I say something, and I don't want to be misinterpreted here, but if global capitalism is a problem, and I think that it's a huge problem, then it is very possible that national socialism is at least one answer. Now, when I'm saying national socialism, I don't try to endorse any kind of a regime from the past, but I want to be clear about what is national socialism. And this is something that I'm taking from a neoconservative writer whom I don't like, but I think that his analysis of this phenomenon is correct. And I'm talking about Jonah Goldberg.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that he wrote his book, Liberal Fascism.
Right.
He said something that I find an extremely astute observation, the way he looks at it. When we think about national socialism, we're talking about nationalism, which is not such a bad idea. Many socialists are also nationalists, and a very great example was probably George Orwell, whom I like a lot. And socialism is also an idea that many of us tend to accept. We accept the idea that we should live somehow in egalitarian condition or share wealth and so on and so on. Italian national socialism, Italian fascism, was referring basically to equality of the Italian people. Now, I'm
right.
Sorry to say, this is not a very bad idea.
Of course not. No.
Again,
no.
Again, I'm not endorsing the tyrannical nature of Mussolini, but Mussolini was popular in Italy, at least in the beginning, because this is how they saw it. And if people don't agree with me, they can go and watch Fellini in Nostalgia, in Nostalgic footage. German national socialism, and this is something that I myself never understood. German national socialism was equality of the German-speaking people. This is why the Austrians were so excited about the Anschluss. I never understood it. This is exactly why there was that interesting conflict in the Sudeten, and this is the battle between German and Czechoslovakia and Britain get involved and so on and so on. Again, equality of German-speaking people or any speaking people is not a big problem. Hitler, however, had a different concept. Hitler believed in equality of one race. Now, equality of one race is slightly more problematic because if you are born into the wrong race in a given culture that adheres to such a concept, you have a serious problem. Now, what is the most important thing to say about the contemporary left in this context? That by making identities that are biologically based, like black, Jews are identified by the blood of the mother, gay, transsexual, and so on and so on, the left actually adopted the most problematic aspect of Hitlerian philosophy. Rather than taking the National Socialist idea of equality within space, location, or language, they actually adopted the idea of biological determinism. How did the left manage to adopt the most problematic aspect of Hitlerian philosophy? This is an interesting question. One of the reasons is because they don't allow debate. So everyone who would point at this issue is himself becoming a fascist and, you know, they attack him from him or her from behind. Now, interestingly enough, I'm saying what I'm saying about Hitler, and it's some revisionists probably won't agree with me. And guess what? I'm opening it to debate. I'm not an historian and I'm not an Hitler specialist. Some people would say that Hitler wasn't actually as racist as we tend to believe and so on and so on. It's an open debate and I'm not clever enough about the topic.
Well, there's a lot here to chew on for sure, Gilad. You have opened up a lot of interesting can of worms here that we can continue to talk more about in the second segment. We're going to take a break here in a little bit. But there's much more actually from the book I want to ask you about in terms of, you know, how, you know, the transformation of our society, how we ended up in this postmodern world. And also, of course, I want to ask you more about what you think we should do to restore some kind of sanity to this picture. So let's talk more about that in the second segment, but again, I just want to plug the book, obviously, Being in Time. Tell us where people can get a copy of the book, Gilad.
You can definitely get it on Amazon.com and Amazon.co.uk. You can buy it from my site, gilad.co.uk. And if you do that, I'll definitely make some money out of it. I guess that you can get it now in all bookshops, or at least order it in your local bookshop. The books are there, and I think that you will enjoy it. It is slightly philosophical, but it explains a lot of problematic issues.
Yeah, you go into this issue of course, the collapse of the left-right, you know, paradigm as well, and what's happened with that. That's an interesting thing that we can discuss more later on as well. A lot of other things in the book, a lot of ideas as usual that Gilad unleashes on you, a lot of things that demands you to think a little bit extra on it. And of course, we'll continue talking about that more in the second segment. So stay with us, Gilad. We'll take a short break, and then we'll be right back with the second segment. Stay tuned.